Okay, well, last time we started to get into Genesis 37, so the first little bit here will be a review. Just want to kind of recap what we did there, but the recording from last week, there was a technical issue with it, so I'll re-record kind of an introduction, and then we'll put the stuff online. That's why it's not there. If you were looking for it, somebody asked me about it. But you can turn to Genesis 37, and we'll begin at 17 through 28. And I just want to remind you of what we're looking for here. So if you think of this tension or this relationship between God's complete sovereignty and human freedom, if you think of it like a spectrum, all the way to the left is God's absolutely determining everything that happens. Human beings don't determine anything that happens in any way. It's just all an illusion, right? It's just God doing stuff. All the way at the other end of the spectrum, God isn't doing anything. We decide everything, right? And so there's an infinite number of views in between. What I think the scripture teaches, what we're going to be looking at in this class, is that both are the case. Human beings are making free choices. Those choices actually do matter. But that ultimately what we choose is what God plans, and that is not a logical or theological violation of our true freedom. And we're looking at text right now to see how some of this works. And then once we get through looking at the passages later, we'll start to unpack some of that a little more. But we're going to start at Genesis 37, 17. And then the question we should ask is, whose choice determined what happened? So 17, well, actually it starts a little bit earlier than this, but this is where I would just start in 12. We're talking about Joseph here. He had these dreams. He's telling his brothers about them. The way he goes about this maybe wasn't very wise. They don't like that. It says, now his brothers went to the pasture to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel says to Joseph, aren't your brothers pasturing their flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. And he said to them, here I am. So he said to him, go now, see if it's well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, what are you seeking? He says, I'm seeking my brothers. And he said, tell me, please, where are they pasturing the flock? And the man says, they've gone away, for I hear them say, let's go up to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. So his father sends him to find his brothers. He's looking for them. He doesn't know where they're at. He finds somebody who tells him where they went, and now he's heading there. Verse 18, then they saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. So notice the pronouns here. They conspired to do this. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him. So you see them planning this, right? These are their choices. They're working this out. And then we'll throw him in one of the pits. Then we will say a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams. But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, let us not take his life. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father. So Reuben is planning to use this to his advantage. But look carefully at the pronouns. Let us, we will do this. They did this. The complete emphasis in the biblical text here is on the agency of these brothers. Do you see that? Okay. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and threw him in the pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. So again, they're planning. There's this planning going on here. You know, they figured it'd be better to make some money here, I guess. And they're planning all this. They all agree in this. It says his brothers agreed with him. Then the Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Now, look at this very last statement in this verse. They, meaning these Ishmaelites, took Joseph to Egypt. There's no mention here at all of anything to do with God, right? This right at this point, the entire emphasis of the narrative is on what these brothers are doing and then what the Ishmaelites did. So if we ask, based upon what we've seen here, how does Joseph end up in Egypt? What would we say, have to say, based upon the teaching of this passage?
His brothers sold him.
His brothers. So who decided that Joseph was going to end up in Egypt?
His brothers.
His brothers, right? His brothers. Okay, well, let's go over to this. Picks back up in chapter 45. Some other things go on in between, but let's look at 1 through 8. So his brothers come back. There's all this interaction. If you know the story, if you want to read more, you can go read this. But in 45, 1 through 8, then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. So maybe I will give you a little bit, right? There's a famine, right? They go to Egypt because Joseph had been, by God's grace, elevated in Egypt, and they had stored up grain. So the people over in Canaan are starving. His father sends the brothers to Egypt to buy grain. And then Joseph kind of interacts with them a little bit. And now they're coming back. He actually does some things to make sure that they get brought back. And then now they're back. And he's going to tell them who he is. So they don't realize it's their brother. Because again, he's completely Egyptian at this point. He's, you know, they don't recognize him for who he is.
Teenage boy.
No, he's not a boy. He's a full-grown man dressed like an Egyptian, probably speaking Egyptian, the whole deal, right? So Joseph, in verse 2, and he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. So this is very emotional for him. He's going to confront his brothers. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. They're speechless and probably terrified, because Joseph's a big deal. He's like the number two guy in all of Egypt. And so it says they were dismayed. Now, why would they be dismayed?
Because they thought he was out of the picture.
But okay, so that's a surprise. Wouldn't they be happy to see their brother alive and doing well?
Now they think he's going to take revenge.
Take revenge. Well, if someone's going to take revenge on you, what does that imply about your perspective on what you did?
Guilty. It wasn't good.
They're guilty. And they know then that they're responsible. So it's their, based upon what we've seen so far, they decide Joseph's going to end up in Egypt. And they know they're responsible for that decision. Do you see that? Their perception is, we did this to him, and now we're in trouble.
I was just wondering, you know how many years went by?
It was decades, but I don't remember the exact, I'd have to look, Tom, I don't remember the exact number, but a lot of stuff happens, right? He's in prison, he gets out of prison, it's decades. So they're dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt."
In case they forgot.
Just in case. Right. You want to know which one I am? Remember the guy that you threw in the pit and sold? Yeah, that's me. So again, in the narrative, where's the agency? Joseph himself says, the brother's decisions led to him being in Egypt, right? So there's a recognition in this text of agency and responsibility. These brothers did this and they're responsible for it. And then he says, "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here. They sold him here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. Wait a minute. Now we have something totally different introduced. Why does he go to Egypt? They sold him. Right. So he doesn't say you just thought you were doing that. No, you did that. But for, because God sent me before you to preserve life. God sent me here. Well, does that mean that his brothers didn't?
Yes.
Yes?
They did do it.
Who sent him?
God sent him.
But the brothers did too.
So if somebody were to ask you, who decided that Joseph will end up in Egypt? There's two answers. You, biblically speaking, you have to give two answers. So from one perspective, you can say God is the one who decided that Joseph ended up in Egypt. But from another perspective, you say, well, how did he end up in Egypt? Well, his brothers sold him. So do you see that you've got to give two answers. Whose intention was it for Joseph to go to Egypt? God's intention. Didn't his brothers have an intention as well? They wanted to make some money.
And get rid of him.
There are two intentions connected to the same action. Right? So how does this work? Let's see what... There's more. But wait, there's more. Where were we?
Six.
For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you for a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So now, in this same conversation, you sold me. I'm the one you sold. But God sent me. God sent me. God sent me. He shifts right in the same conversation from emphasizing their agency to God's agency. Do you see that? It's not like in two different chapters. This is the same conversation. Joseph is connecting these two intentions in his own work. So now look what he says in verse 8. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord of all his house and a ruler over all the land of Egypt. So it's not you who sent me here. Well, did they send him there?
Yeah,
they did send him there. Why would he say that?
Because ultimately it was God's sovereign plan for him to end up there.
Right. So he's looking at this from the perspective of this overall plan. But he's not. I mean, he just told them, you sold me there. He knows they sold him there. Why would he say this to his brothers, do you think?
Trying to let them off the hook.
Yeah, well, they were terrified and speechless, and he's saying, look, you did this. Like, I know you did it. But understand something, that there's a purpose in this. That's what he's conveying to them. I think that's why he's sharing this. But from our perspective, studying this, you say, well, who ultimately chooses which future comes into existence? In this case, you have to give two answers. Now, what is the relationship between those two answers? We'll explore that as the class goes. But I want you to see in the text, if we were just looking at chapter 37, you have to answer the brothers' decisions are what led to this. Here in chapter 45, you have to say, well, there's a little bit of two things going on. Let's look at chapter 50, because there is even some more on this narrative here. Beginning at verse 15, we're going to get a little bit more explanation here. So when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, okay, again, you can go back and read. There's some things that happen in the interim. They said, it may be now that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. So what happens is when he confronts them, he asks, what's the first thing he asks them? Is my father alive? right? And they're like, yeah, he's alive. So then there's this whole intervening story. Now his father has died, and now they're afraid again. Why?
Because now he'll take revenge on
us. Right. Maybe the only reason he let us off the hook is because he didn't want to, you know, give the old man a heart attack. Now they're worried. Like, okay. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because of the evil they did to you. So he's like, you know, dad said.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is what they put in this message. What are they asking for?
Forgiveness
for what?
For
an evil that they did, for a transgression, for an evil that they did to you. Who did it to them, to him?
His brothers.
Yeah. Do they understand they're responsible for it?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Otherwise, this wouldn't be a concern for them. So, they recognize this. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. Oh, this is really good. They're really laying it on. Dad wants you to forgive us. Oh, and we're servants of the same God you are, as we lie to you. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him. So this is the fulfillment of the dream, by the way, one of the parts of that. And said, behold, we are your servants. So let's look at how Joseph responds to this. But Joseph said to them in verse 19, do not fear. For am I in the place of God? And here's the key verse, I think, and we'll build on this as we go through the other examples. As for you, you meant evil against me. So stop here. There's agency. They made decisions. They were planning. They were exercising choices. Nobody made them do this. You know? And what was their motivation? You meant, so see that word meant? That refers to intent. So whose intention was it for him to end up in Egypt? Well, they had an intention in sending him to Egypt. And what was it? Evil. But now look, there's two intentions connected to the same act. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Now, here's what happens to this passage constantly. I've heard sermons on it. I've heard classes on it. You meant it for evil, but God used it for good. Is that what it says?
No.
It doesn't say that. God isn't sitting here reacting to everything we're doing. Joseph ended up in Egypt because God wanted him there. He didn't just make the best out of this choice these brothers made. God wanted him there. He meant it. Joseph ends up in Egypt because God meant for him to be there. And his brothers meant for him to be there. But see what is happening here? Two different motivations, two different desires related to that same action. And that's going to become really important. And I'm going to show you some other examples of that. And when we start to unpack, well, how can I be making free choices if God's already decided what's going to happen? This idea of intent and desire is critical to that, to understanding that relationship. So that's what he says here. And then he basically, do not fear, I'll provide for you and your littered ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. By the way, I really do suggest that if you have time this week, you go back and read this story, because Joseph is he's pointing us to Christ in so many ways. It's just a rich, rich story. But in terms of what we're studying here, two intentions. God isn't just, you know, a handyman that comes behind us and fixes the stuff we do. We got to try to wrap our head around this. He uses the sin of these people to bring about something that he wants done. But who's responsible for it? Well, the brothers are. They know they're guilty. So this is the hard part. Well, how do they sin? And God planned this. Is God the author of sin? No, he's not. Well, but that we'll get to some of these harder questions. But I just want you to see from the narrative, There's no question. If you ask, what does Genesis say about who decided Joseph ends up in Egypt? You have to give two answers. And in fact, Joseph makes it clear that we're not just reading into this, because at the end he says, you meant it for this, God meant it for this. There's two intentions going on in that. Do you see that?
Yeah.
Any questions about that?
We have to learn to change our mindset. It's not, like you said, it's not that the brothers did this and God said, oh, well, let me hurry up and fix the situation. God, in his sovereignty, allowed that to happen.
Well, it doesn't say he allowed it. He intended it to happen.
Well, right. But he was still in control, but yet it was still their choice.
Yes, that's true. But when we say, we just have to be careful with the language, because when we say God allowed something, it's almost like, he didn't want that to happen, but I'm not going to intervene.
Well, yeah,
and
no,
in the text it says he intend.
Way.
I know. I'm just clarifying so that we can get these categories straight. That's the hard thing. You look at this and say, well, God intended this. And we know that this isn't something that comes along later either, because it was these dreams that led to them. So think about this. Who gave him the dreams?
God
gave him the dreams. Now, he's kind of foolish in the way he shares those dreams.
But
what made the brothers angry at him in the first place? Those dreams.
Yeah.
So God gives him these dreams. He probably is very unwise in how he shares these dreams. Yet, his youth and inexperience. And you know, he probably was a little bit of a pain in the rear end. But I think... Right, even his father was like, hey, don't say stuff like that. But the point is, from beginning to end, like, God even uses his lack of wisdom in how he communicates the dreams
to bring about
this whole thing. I mean, in every case, people are making decisions. And they're responsible for those decisions, and those decisions have consequences. But what happens is what God had planned to have happen. So how do we work through that? We've got 7 more weeks. Isaiah 10. Let's look at Isaiah 10. This is one, a lot of people talk about the Joseph story, but I don't hear a lot of people talk about this one, and I think it's really clear here too. So in Isaiah 10, we're talking about Assyria. So who is Assyria? They're an enemy, right? It's an empire really kind of based in what is now sort of northern Syria and Turkey. The Assyrian Empire was a very powerful empire, very brutal enemy of Israel. So we're talking here about the king of Assyria and the Assyrians. So in the beginning of chapter 10, we'll just work our way through here. Woe to those who decree iniquitous decrees. Okay? So the first thing he's going to talk about in this chapter are, well, what does woe mean? It's not like it's not like surfer woe. This is a different kind of woe.
It's doom and destruction.
It's not good. Woe is a term, a prophetic term, that tells you a curse is being proclaimed or upon somebody. Woe to him who does whatever is, you are cursed if you do this. That's what it means. So evil things are going to come to you if you do this. So woe to those who decree iniquitous decrees. And he's talking about all this unjust stuff. And then we're going to jump down to verse 5, because one of the people involved in this is the king of Assyria. So listen, look at this. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in their hands is my fury. Well, that's not even what I was going to talk about, but we should address that. Woe to Assyria, meaning curse you, Assyria, right? Because you've done these things. Curses are going to come. Evil is going to come to you because you did this. Well, what did they do? Well, look at this. Woe to Assyria. I'm going to punish you, Assyria. You are the rod of my anger. Wait, what? Did you catch that?
I'm going to use you.
I'm going to use you.
He was the instrument.
The staff, in their hands is my fury. So here, I want you to understand the context here. Assyria is an enemy of Israel. They're coming up against Israel, and they're brutal. They're just brutal. They're going to slaughter people. They're going to starve people. And it's like the Lord's saying, because you do that, you're going to be cursed because you're coming against my people. But why are they coming?
Because he's using
them. Do you see that? The rod in their hands is the staff of his fury. Well, let's keep going a little bit. Against a godless nation I send him, and against the people of my wrath I command him. Right? So God is using Assyria to discipline Israel. And God says, I'm bringing this about. Do you see that? To do what? To take spoil and seize plunder? To tread them down like the mire of the streets? Well, that's the thing. We have this, I mean, there's this skewed view. I mean, the God of the Bible doesn't take any prisoners. I mean, this is serious. And he's saying, I'm going to bring you to, I mean, very, very powerful discipline against Israel. Because Israel sinned, right? Against a godless nation I send him. So Israel's failed to worship God the way they should. So he raises up Assyria, and he's going to punish Assyria, even though Assyria is executing the discipline that the Lord brings him to do. Well, how's that just? How's that fair? I want you to think about this. At the bottom of that question, how can God hold Assyria responsible when God raised them up to do the things that they're going to do? It's the same question we're studying, isn't it? It's the same issue. How are we responsible? Is the king of Assyria making free choices here? Well, then what? Okay, then how, in what sense is God doing this? God's doing it. Well, let's see. Look at the next verse. This will start to look familiar to you, thinking of Joseph. But he does not so intend, and his heart does not so think. He's talking about the king of Assyria. Assyria is going to come and do horrible things. God's using them to do that for his purpose. But look at verse 7. But he, the king of Assyria, or Assyria, does not so intend. And his heart does not so think. But in his heart is to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. And look what he's going to say. For he says, the king of Assyria says, are not my commanders all kings? Is not Calno like Carchemish? Is not Hamath like Arpad? Is not Samaria like Damascus? Listen to this king. As my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols whose carved images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her idols as I have done to Samaria and her images? What is this king doing? He's arrogant. He's looking at Israel and saying, I have defeated bigger gods than yours. Right?
Yeah.
In fact, this whole little thing about are not all my commanders kings? Like, the lieutenants in my army are like the generals in yours. Right? The little towns in my kingdom are like your big cities. The power differential, the arrogance, the hubris of this king is enormous. God's raised him up to do these things, to bring judgment on Israel. But what does this king think? Yeah, who does he...
He thinks he's a god.
He thinks he's a god. He thinks he's doing this. He's able to make progress militarily against Israel because the father is bringing him to do this for a purpose, but he sees that and thinks it's in his own strength and his own power that he's doing this, right? So he's arrogant. He's puffed up. So who decides that Assyria is going to come against Israel? God? Okay. What about the king?
Through him.
Through, well, they both, who, but who makes the decision to go attack Israel?
The king.
The king? You have to give two answers to this. Do you see that? You have to answer it two different ways. Now, look at what it says in verse 12, because God's using this king, but he's not done with him. When the Lord has finished all his work on Mount Zion on Jerusalem, he will punish the speech of the arrogant and the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the boastful look in his eyes. For he says, speaking of the king says, by the strength of my hand have I done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding. I remove the boundaries of the people and plunder their treasures. Like a bull, I bring down those who are sitting on thrones. My hand has found like a nest the wealth of the peoples, and as one gathers eggs that have been forsaken, so I have gathered from the earth, and there was none that moved a wing or opened the mouth or chirped. So this king is saying, I did this. And God's saying, yeah? Verse 15, shall the axe boast over him who hews with it, or the saw magnify itself against he who wields it, as if a rod should wield him who lifts it, or as if a staff should lift him who is not wood? Therefore the Lord God of hosts will send a wasting sickness among his stout warriors, and under the glory of a burning will be kindled like the burning of a fire. The light of Israel will become a fire, and his Holy One a flame, and it will burn and devour his thorns and briars in one day. So God says, when I'm done with you, you're done. So... But this is a really interesting passage, isn't it? It's a really interesting dynamic, because we see this king saying, I'm going to attack Israel, and I'm going to conquer, and I'm going to plunder. He decided with his own motivations to do this. Does God make him do something he doesn't want to do? Not at all. He has an intention. What is his intention?
He's allowing him
to destroy nations.
To destroy Israel. But we also have to say that the reason the Assyrians are able to plunder Jerusalem is because God determined that that would happen. Do you see how this... So there's two intentions. And what is God's intention? It's hinted at here. Yeah. Yeah, when the Lord has finished all his work on Mount Zion and Jerusalem, well, what is he... Let's go back to the beginning of where he says, against a godless nation, right? Even the king of Assyria mentions idols in Israel, doesn't he? Well, what was going on in Israel? They were worshiping idols. They weren't worshiping God. So God raises up this Assyrian king to chastise them. But when he's done with that, he's going to deal with the king of Assyria. Well, how is it righteous for God to punish this king for doing what God lifted him up to do?
Because he was only fulfilling the evilness that was already in his heart.
Right. God didn't make him do... It's not like God said to the king, I want you to attack Israel. And he said, no, I don't really want to do that. And God made him do it. This guy's doing what he wants to do. He's following the evil intentions of his heart. And that's part of God's plan to chastise his people and purify his people. So we have to give two answers to why does the king of Assyria come against Israel? God intended it. He had a purpose for it. What was God's purpose? To purify Israel. What was the king's intention?
Destruction.
Destruction, right? So similar to the Joseph story, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Do you see that dynamic here where there's this, it's not that God just reacted to, okay, this guy wants to do this, I'm going to use that and kind of figure this out how to get some good out of it. He says, you're the rod of my anger, but you're boasting like an axe would boast. It doesn't make any sense for an axe to boast against the one who wields it. So, I mean, the very breath in this king's lungs is a gift of God. So for him to say these things is ridiculous. So do you see in this passage this sort of same dynamic that we saw in the last one? So one of the things that is going to be real important as we start to think about how these things fit together, it has to do with desire and motive. And we'll continue to unpack that as we go through the course. Let's look at Acts chapter 2. And by the way, if you're sitting there right now and you sort of have this sort of Charlie horse in between your ears, that's okay. This is not like somebody tells you and you just go, oh yeah, like we really need to think about these things, and we will. I just want to show you in these texts some of the observations about why I'm saying that what God deciding what happens and us deciding what happens have to be, biblically speaking, compatible with each other in some way. They both are true because the Bible says that we're responsible for our actions and that they matter, and the Bible says God determines all things. So there has to be a way to bring these together, and we will look at that. But let's look at chapter 2, verse 22. Right now, I just want to show you that the Bible does, in fact, teach that this is the case, that both things are happening. We're going to look at Peter's sermon at Pentecost. So we've looked at a couple other. We've looked at Joseph. We looked at the king of Assyria. I want to look now at the most important decision that's ever occurred. And how did that work out? So, but Peter, remember the Spirit's poured out on them, right? They're hiding up in this upper room. The Spirit's poured out on them and they go outside and Peter's going to preach. Standing with the 11, lifted up his voice and addressed the crowd. Men of Judea and all who dwell in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and give ear to my words. For these people are not drunk as you suppose, since it's only the third hour of the day. I always find that funny. I probably shouldn't, but it's not like these. Of course, these guys don't drink. It's like, no, it's too early. Maybe that's just my sense of humor. I probably should have kept that to myself. But this is what was uttered through the prophet Joel. So Peter's first point is, look, what you're witnessing here is the fulfillment of a prophecy. And he's going to quote this: in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams, even my male servants and female servants. In those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And I will show wonders in the heavens and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the great day of the Lord comes, the great and magnificent day. And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. So he's quoting these prophecies and he's applying them to what's happening here at Pentecost. The last age has started. What you're witnessing here is the beginning of the final chapter of the story. And then verse 22, he's going to get very specific about what the key event that kicks this off, right? Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know, this Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death because it was not possible for him to be held by it. And then he's going to talk about what David says. But this is a very interesting comment. This Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. So, who decides that Jesus goes to the cross? God does. he's not just reacting to what people are doing. There's a definite plan and foreknowledge. He knew beforehand that this plan is going to work this way. So God plans for Jesus to go to the cross. You crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. Who sends Jesus to the cross? Who does? People
cried out for his
blood. Right. What people? Let's think about it, because there's a lot of people involved in this. The Jews, the Jewish leaders, the Jewish, the crowd. Give us Barabbas instead. Right? What about Pilate? Pilate's like, hey, I don't want nothing to do with this. But that's what you want. So all of these people make decisions that could have been, idea you'd think, possibly, could have been different decisions. They all do what they want to do. And that leads to Jesus being delivered and crucified, right? And it says, who did this? You did this. You crucified him, Peter says. But God crucified him. Do you see that? There's both here in the same sentence. So this idea that like these things are irreconcilable cannot be true scripturally. Part of the biblical worldview is that there are things that are happening. And all three of the examples that I've shown you are sins. And I wanted to do that because it's the most extreme way to look at it, right? You know, is God working through us all the time, we think. But when you start talking about the greatest sin that's ever occurred in the history of the universe, that lawless men take the Prince of Peace and deliver him over and crucify him, there's not been anything that's ever occurred that is more heinous, more ridiculous, more evil than that. And it was the definite plan of God. Do you see that? It's like hard to wrap our heads around that. And we'll spend weeks kind of processing these narratives. But that's what it says, right? It doesn't say, you guys did this, but God's, you know, pretty crafty, so he figured out how to use it.
Sometimes people want to excuse the evil because they say it was God's plan. They want to excuse the sin and the evil of what the people did.
Yeah, but you know something? I have heard people do that now. I have had people tell me, well, God made me this way. Mm-hmm. Or, well, if that's what happened, that's what God wanted. And it's like a complete twisting of this idea of God's providence and sovereignty. Mm-hmm. Now, is it true? Well, I mean, in some sense, obviously, it happened in the world, and so God has a plan for it. So in that sense, but if you think that means you're not responsible for it, that's a whole different thing, because Jesus says of Judas, who turns him over, it would have been better if he had never been born. But what does Jesus say about him? I chose you 12 and one of you is a devil. You see what I'm saying? It all fits together. And so if we're going to have a mature faith and a mature understanding of the word, even though it's uncomfortable, and when you first start to hear these things and think about it, it's jarring. We have to come to terms with how these fit together. Or you just have to, some people can do that. Well, it says this, I'm good with it. I'm not built that way. I'm like, wait a minute. I gotta try to understand. Not that we know, we're not going to be able to answer every question. But I do think it's important for us to have a working understanding of the fact that God is in control of things, and yet he's righteous in holding us accountable, because it's personal. This, how we answer this question affects how we think of our salvation, how we think about what is happening when we pray, how we think about what's happening when we witness to people. This idea of freedom and sovereignty, I think the reason people bring it up so much, because there are more difficult theological questions. How can Jesus Christ be fully human and fully divine? I think is far more complex than this, but this is so personal that we recognize it as personal in a way that we might not think about the Trinity. But that's what he says. Now let's look at chapter 4, 26. Oh, no, let's not do that. We're out of time. All right, we'll stop here and we'll pick up next week, Lord willing.